You're listening to Branch Out by Sycamore.
You left standard practice and became an independent physician, operating your own business and doing locum tenens. How much of that played a role in your willingness to think outside the box, to challenge the mainstream? Do you feel like that's played any part in your ability to sort of see some of these realities that you weren't seeing before?
Oh, certainly. How devastatingly the healthcare system has failed around the issue of metabolic health and nutrition just opened my eyes to a lot of other things in medicine specifically and in society on a larger scale. And then to have something like COVID come along, it's been obvious to anyone who wants to look, all the statistics are out there that being metabolically unhealthy puts you at higher risk for COVID. So why have we not heard one public health official come out and talk about getting metabolically healthy? Why hasn't Dr. Fauci or anyone else come out and say, let's get metabolically healthy and we can do all the other stuff that we think might help minimize the impact of COVID? You don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but sometimes it becomes hard to comprehend of another reason why that isn't being said.
Well, the food industry isn't interested in people stopping eating carbs, and the big pharma is not interested in people stopping taking statins.
I'm Larson Hicks, CEO of Sycamore, and welcome to Branch Out, where I chat with healthcare professionals about broad-reaching topics like their careers in medicine, hobbies and pursuits outside the hospital, and everything in between.
We've got a very special guest this morning. I'm excited to have with us Dr. Ovadia, who is a certified cardiac surgeon, also has his own practice, does virtual telehealth, metabolic health, and has a pretty interesting take on heart disease. And I'm really excited to have him on the show and hear his story. So thanks for joining us, Dr. Ovadia.
Oh, thank you for having me, Larson. I'm really excited to connect with the Sycamore audience here. And I think this is going to be a great discussion.
Yeah, likewise. Well, so just to kind of frame this up, so we also have another guest who's going to join us here, Larry Hicks, who you might recognize the same last name as my dad, and he spent 40 years as a medical malpractice defense attorney, just retired this last year, and as I told him about this conversation, he was really intrigued and excited, and I think he'll add a lot of value to the conversation when we get deeper into it. So we're excited to have him join us as well. It's kind of a different format. It's usually one-on-one. It'll be fun to have a third wheel to the conversation. But just to kind of frame up the purpose and the goal and the aim of our podcast, we're a company that is really interested in physician autonomy. I believe that a healthcare system with doctors who are autonomous, who have greater independence and control over their careers, is going to be a better healthcare system. I think the corporatization of medicine has been a bad thing on a lot of different levels, and so it's not all bad, obviously, but there's definitely a lot of problems I think that have come with that, and so we love talking to physicians who have branched out. And are doing kind of their own thing. And, you know, there's, most of the physicians we talk with, you know, practiced in the hospital for a long time or in kind of a traditional practice setting, and then have in a kind of a second chapter of their careers branched out into some new, venture, whether it's a medical venture or something completely different. So you're somebody who has branched out, and we are really eager to hear about how you've done that and what you've done. And so anyway, that's just kind of the background and why we do this podcast. I love to just kind of hear about your background, but I'd also maybe just as a initial, level setting question, can you tell me what you think the purpose, the goal, the mission of a physician is?
Sure thing. You know, that's a subject that is something I touch on a lot in my messaging, and I talk about a lot, and it really fits into, you know, my backstory as well. So just to kind of briefly go through that, I am a, you know, doubly board certified cardiothoracic surgeon. I did pretty traditional medical school and then general surgical residency, and then a fellowship in cardiothoracic surgery, and was in practice as a cardiothoracic surgeon for over 15 years. All of that time as an employed physician, so always working for healthcare systems. And obviously, you know, cardiac surgery, heart surgery involves a lot of expertise, a lot of specialized care. You need a lot of support services around you. And, you know, when you look at the sort of economics around cardiothoracic surgery, you know, it has evolved in such a way that over the past 20 to 30 years, essentially private practice cardiothoracic surgery has been eliminated. I believe it's less than 5% of the cardiothoracic surgeons in this country today are still in private practice. And what happened was about 5 years ago, I, again, just on the personal side of things, found myself to be somewhat unhealthy. I was overweight. I was pre-diabetic. And I had struggled my whole life with obesity and had done all the normal things and followed all the traditional advice without success. And I was kind of introduced to an alternative idea about 5 years ago. I saw a talk by a journalist by the name of Gary Taubes. At that time, he had just released a book called The Case Against Sugar. And prior to that, Why We Get Fat and Good Calories, Bad Calories. And, you know, he was the first, it was the first time that I had really heard about concepts around, you know, essentially low carbohydrate nutrition and why, more importantly, it kind of highlighted how we had failed in the battle against obesity and the food pyramid and the whole low fat movement, that, you know, was promoted, you know, starting in the 1980s, had just, you know, been failing miserably. And I saw that personally, and I saw that in all my patients. And so, you know, learning about that and then learning the history of why that information was not widely available, you know, really opened my eyes to some of the failings of the healthcare system. And, you know, it's a mix of, you know, politics and business, pharmaceutical interest, food, you know, industry interest. But needless to say, really opened my eyes to things. And, you know, at the same time, as I improved my health, and then I started talking about this with my patients, and again, seeing how the system really, you know, wouldn't allow that, essentially. You know, there have been physicians, you know, there have actually been other physicians who have been brought up on charges, have had their medical licenses challenged, because they espoused, you know, things around low carb nutrition, for instance. And so, again, that just kind of showed me, you know, where our medical system had evolved to. And what I really came to realize was how the patient-physician relationship had been corrupted, and all of the influences that have gotten in between the patients and the physicians. And again, whether that's administrators, insurance companies, pharmaceutical companies, you know, even the food industry has a, you know, significant influence on medicine. So I really found it more and more difficult each day to function traditionally within the system. So that led me down a couple of paths. I, you know, left my employed position and started doing locums cardiothoracic surgical work. I still do that. And then I also launched a telemedicine practice, Ovadia Heart Health, which is focused on the prevention of heart disease and other chronic diseases through dietary and lifestyle interventions. And, you know, my kind of tagline, my motto is stay off my operating table. I would rather at this point help patients prevent heart disease and not need my services as a cardiac surgeon than, you know, to operate on them as a cardiac surgeon. Now, you know, I feel very blessed to be able to do cardiac surgery and to be able to offer that service to the people who need it. But what I've really come to realize is that every patient I operate on as a cardiac surgeon is a patient that the healthcare system has failed, because heart disease, it should be preventable in the vast majority of cases. And it really comes down to pretty simple concepts around metabolic health, diet, lifestyle. And instead, you know, like so many other things in medicine, we want to focus on pharmaceuticals and, you know, just trying to manage health problems instead of prevent and reverse health problems. And so that's become my passion now.
I love it. That's a great, wonderful story. And I want to dig a lot deeper into all of this just to kind of summarize and add some color and make some comments and get your feedback on a couple of the things you said. In my simplistic understanding of what the purpose of a physician is, it's to help, you know, patients, one, you know, individual by individual, ascertain, you know, what their medical challenges, problems are, and arrive at a treatment plan, you know, that helps them get healthy. And all of this has been complicated by the fact that we've got insurance companies now who are paying the bill. So patients aren't paying a physician anymore. They're paying an insurance company. Insurance companies are deciding what treatments they think are worth paying for and aren't. And then on the medicine side, you know, on the drug side, you've got these large pharmaceutical companies who are paying for, you know, most of this research and science and sort of options that interventions that physicians have. And so it just seems like this whole thing has gotten pretty complicated to an extent that there's a bias now, it seems, towards intervention, whether it's pharmaceutical intervention or surgical intervention.
Yeah, certainly. So when you go back to, you know, what a physician should be, you know, the Latin root of, doctor is, you know, a teacher, an educator. And ultimately, you know, physicians should be here, like you said, to educate their patients about, you know, health and about, you know, the diseases that might afflict them and the options, you know, on how to treat that. And it's, you know, key to understand that, you know, we're not here to tell patients what to do. You know, people are surprised to hear me say, you know, even as a heart surgeon, I don't tell patients you need to have heart surgery. You know, I talk with them about their conditions and where, you know, heart surgery might fit in as an option for that. But if for whatever reason, you know, even if I think that heart surgery is truly the best option for a certain situation, if the patient decides they don't want to have heart surgery, for whatever reason, you know, it's not my role to dictate that to them. And I will still work with them on, you know, whatever other options they choose. And as you said, you know, the options that are presented to patients these days are often, you know, colored by not what is best for the patient, but what is best for the healthcare system. And, you know, that can take the form of insurance companies denying, you know, care because it's judged not to be cost effective. It can be guidelines that, you know, kind of force doctors' hands as to how certain, you know, conditions need to be treated. Again, without any real, you know, without taking into account that every patient is unique. And, you know, guidelines play a role. You know, they can help. Obviously, you know, every doctor can't know everything about every condition, even the ones they commonly treat. And so guidelines can help to, you know, bring together some of the information and sort of show what might be best. But we got to realize that those guidelines are incomplete. They can't be, you know, tailored to each individual. And also, unfortunately, these guidelines are oftentimes heavily influenced by other forces such as the pharmaceutical industry. And so, you know, we've gotten into a situation now, and this has become, you know, very obvious in our current environment that, you know, anything that questions things like guidelines, anything that goes against what is felt to be, you know, the mainstream by the healthcare system, gets looked upon negatively, gets questioned, and those physicians are often put under undue scrutiny when, you know, in the end, a lot of us are just trying to do what we feel is best for the patient, help the patient decide what is best for them. And that's looked upon negatively by the healthcare system.
There's something really paternalistic about, I think, the way that medicine has become. And you bring up a really good point about sort of the, you mentioned at the top of the call, the fact that there have been physicians who have had their medical licenses revoked because of recommending metabolic strategies to address heart disease. And I didn't even mention when I was talking about some of the big players in medicine being insurance companies, I was thinking health insurance and then also, pharmaceutical, but you bring up the other elephant in the room, which is medical malpractice, right? And the threat that doctors are under, to provide quote unquote standard of care. And that's always a concern that I don't want to do anything outside. I don't want to paint outside the, you know, lines or I might get slapped.
Yeah, and I'm sure your dad will have much to say about this. But, you know, again, medical malpractice has evolved to a point of, you know, what it was originally intended to, which was, you know, to be able to compensate patients if they truly received negligent care, to now it's a system, you know, that's utilized for any, you know, anyone that strays, you know, outside of what is felt to be, you know, the mainstream, I guess we can call it. You know, malpractice is a constant threat there. And again, you know, that's not what it was originally intended to be. And again, I would say that that's not the, you know, what it should be. You know, there are unfortunately truly, you know, patients that are harmed by care that is substandard. But the net has been cast much more broadly by the malpractice system, you know, recently.
The sad thing about it is that the malpractice seems to start with a poor outcome. So if you have a less than desirable outcome, then the default position that a lot of plaintiff malpractice lawyers take is, okay, we have a bad outcome. Let's see if we can figure out how to make this negligence. And that's difficult. And for the most part, the system will sort that out. But in the process, the doctor has gone through the ringer, having to defend himself in him or herself in a situation that he knows or she knows that he did nothing wrong. And it makes doctors, particularly subspecialists like surgeons, it makes them nervous because they begin to see every patient as a potential plaintiff.
Yeah. And then, you know, again, out to, you know, kind of a little bit separate from malpractice, but it's gotten to a point where licensing boards can come after physicians for anything that they perceive to be, not within the standard of care. When we again look at the current issues going on in the healthcare system and trying to question some of the narratives that are out there, just raising those questions, can get you on the radar of the licensing boards, and that becomes very problematic. You know, I would say that, you know, the patients, do not want physicians who are not able to question, things. Medicine was not has not made advances because people were afraid to question things. You know, you look at all the great medical advances that have been made, new surgical procedures, medications, all of the treatments that we have available to us, those did not come about because people were afraid to, question the norm. And quite frankly, heart surgery is a great example of that. You know, heart surgery as a specialty is pretty young. It's only about 60 years old. And the original heart surgeons were called crazy, and the concept that you could operate on someone's heart, was felt to be, quite frankly, crazy, 70, 80, 100 years ago, that concept would have been, labeled as, outside the standard of care, heretic, all of that stuff. But there were some brave, physicians who were willing to question that and, get us to advance. And I think we're in an environment now where thinking like that is not tolerated. And I think that's going to have devastating consequences for the future of healthcare.
Well, one of the things that, I mean, as you talk about that, and I'm always cognizant of the fact that I probably sound like a conspiracy theorist at times, and I really don't want to, and I don't like that orientation. But there are, it's what you said about, just skepticism being skepticism seems like it should be part of one of the core virtues of a man or woman of science, right? And anymore, science, quote unquote science, is the bludgeon which is used to compel compliance to the status quo, whatever that might be. And so, we see this in all manner of other areas where science is telling us to do X, and if you're conscientiously, you and your physician armed with a lot of information are skeptical, you're anti-science, which somehow has become the cut down for anybody who disagrees with the prevailing mainstream theory.
Yeah, exactly. The scientific method, can never prove anything. The scientific method is designed to disprove things. We are supposed to, raise hypotheses, and then you're supposed to work to disprove your hypothesis. That should be the goal of a true scientist. And, again, the examples are all around us. If you look at, what I focus on, metabolic health and nutrition, 40 and 50 years ago in the 1970s, 1980s, we were facing an epidemic of heart disease and a rising obesity. And, there was a hypothesis at that time that, eating more fat is what was making us fat. And, it seemed to make sense. And so we started down the pathway. We said, okay, the U.S. dietary guidelines were introduced, low-fat, diets were introduced. And here we are 40 years later, and the results speak for themselves. I mean, we are more unhealthy than we have ever been. 88% of the adults in the United States are not metabolically healthy. 60 to 75%, depending on, what kind of sample you look at, are overweight or obese. The heart disease remains the number one killer in the United States. And that has, not been changed in the past 30 years. And so when you look at that empirically, you have to say, okay, our hypothesis must have been wrong. But if you question the narrative that, low-fat diets are the only way to keep your heart healthy and to keep your heart, keep you healthy overall, and everyone's cholesterol must be lowered to the absolute, lowest level possible with medications, you're, as you said, you're labeled, you know, a conspiracy theorist, crazy, you know, all of this. And I'm just here saying, I'm just looking around me and seeing that what we're doing is failing. So we got to try something different. But there's no room for that.
You touched on cholesterol, which I figured we'd get into here. So I imagine that the patients you've operated on over the years had high cholesterol. And I also imagine they were on statins. What's the problem?
When you actually look at the statistics around that, you know, what you see is that more than half of the patients that end up having, you know, coronary artery bypass surgery, the most common heart surgery I do, which is a treatment for atherosclerotic heart disease, buildup of blockages in the arteries, more than half of those patients have, you know, low, what are considered normal cholesterol levels. Some of them, because they're on medications, they previously had high, you know, and again, when we look at when mainstream medicine talks about cholesterol for heart disease, they're only referring to one type of cholesterol, LDL cholesterol, which is the type of cholesterol that gets modulated by, you know, statins and other medications. But when you look at the statistics, more than half, in some samples, up to 70% of patients undergoing coronary artery bypass have what are considered low, you know, normal to low cholesterol levels. And like I said, some of them are on medications to cause those low levels. Some of them, many of them are not. And yet, you know, we still think that cholesterol is the singular cause of heart disease. And again, just looking at it from a logical and scientific standpoint, you know, there's no way that cholesterol can be the singular cause of heart disease. And yet half of the patients or more than half of the patients who end up with heart disease, you know, don't have high cholesterol levels.
That seems obvious. Well, why then, I find it interesting that you go to a doctor. I remember going to a doctor once after it's kind of funny in retrospect, but I spent a long weekend at a wedding, you know, where there was, you know, attended a bachelor party, lot of eating, you know, barbecue and drinking a lot of beer. And I came home from that trip with what felt like an ulcer, you know, and went to my doctor and, he put me on a proton pump inhibitor, right? Drug. And it eventually helped. Right. But as I've grown older and I'm less inclined to medical intervention in that way. One day I had a similar situation and I just posited, I wonder if I just fasted for a day, what that would do to this gut situation. And lo and behold, it worked really, really well. I was like, I wonder how many physicians who have somebody come into their office with those kinds of symptoms would reach maybe first for something like fasting.
Yeah, very, very few. You know, obviously I now, you know, understand this. And I think that, you know, focusing on metabolic health and proper diet and lifestyle should be the first line in the vast majority of conditions we treat, quite honestly. But it's not. And, you know, the example you gave is a perfect example. And again, getting back to heart disease. You know, when you go to your primary care physician or your cardiologist and they see that your cholesterol is elevated, even if we do think, if we accept for a minute that elevated cholesterol is, you know, a problem around heart disease, again, why is the first treatment for that a medication? Why don't we say, okay, let's make some changes in the diet that might lower the cholesterol? You know, now again, I even go back a step and I no longer accept the narrative that high LDL cholesterol is causative of heart disease. And I think more important, and again, the data supports this, you know, metabolic disease, metabolic syndrome is a much bigger risk factor for heart disease than an isolated elevation in your LDL cholesterol. The data is very clear on that. You know, but physicians don't know that data. Physicians oftentimes aren't allowed to see that data. That data is intentionally kind of hidden, because, you know, it doesn't, it doesn't continue to support this sort of narrative that, you know, we got to do everything we can to lower cholesterol. And again, I'm not saying that, you know, these medications don't have any role in the treatment of heart disease or that cholesterol doesn't play any part in the development of heart disease. I'm just saying we need to take a more holistic view of this. And we, you know, need not to be so focused on just one number, because that's what the pharmaceutical industry has created the guidelines to direct physicians that, you know, our only focus in preventing heart disease should be on lowering LDL cholesterol levels.
Dr. Vadi, I've heard that that rather than cholesterol being the best indicator of potential heart disease or heart attack or stroke, that actually the ratio between your waist size and your height and the ratio between your LDL and triglycerides is a better marker for those things than cholesterol ever was. What do you think about that?
Yeah, so that's exactly right. You know, when you look at, metabolic health, there are five measurements. There are five things we measure to determine metabolic health. And those five things are your waist circumference, your blood pressure, your fasting blood glucose, and then your HDL cholesterol and your triglycerides. LDL cholesterol is not one of those measurements. So when you look at your waist circumference, and then you look at the ratio between your HDL, your triglycerides, and your HDL cholesterol, those are both indicators of metabolic health. And again, when you look at the statistics, each of those are much greater predictors of the risk of heart disease than LDL cholesterol is. So you have to wonder, why do we continue to focus, you know, so much on LDL cholesterol when, the data, you know, points us in other directions? And, you know, I will admit, you know, I didn't understand this prior to a couple of years ago. You know, I spent the first, 10 to 12 years of my practice as a cardiac surgeon focused on cholesterol. I sort of criticize myself a lot now, and I say, how did I not, realize this? You know, how did it not set off the alarm bells that, you know, every day I was operating on patients with a normal LDL cholesterol level, patients who weren't obese, what is going on there? Over the past 2 years now, obviously, I've come to understand this. And so I look at every patient of mine and I look at their LDL cholesterol, but I also look at the ratio between their HDL, and their triglycerides, their waist circumference. I'll oftentimes measure insulin levels on them and determine if they are metabolically healthy or not. And the bottom line is, in the past 2 years, while I've been looking for that, I continue to see plenty of patients with a normal, low to normal LDL cholesterol level who are on my table for an operation. I am yet to find a metabolically healthy patient who doesn't smoke on my operating room table for an operation. And that's the bottom line.
An interesting point, and I don't want to take away from your presentation, but I can tell you that my life supports what you're saying. I was 40 plus years as a medical malpractice defense lawyer and very involved in a high stress job in a high stressed area. When I retired at the end of the year and decided to get serious about my health, and I've always been an exerciser, I've always been a runner or a cyclist or triathlons and things like that, but I've always also been a big guy. So about 4 months ago, I started doing a low-carb diet and low-carb, high-fat type diet, or what they might call a keto diet, although I don't know that I'm totally keto, but certainly low-carb. And before I started, I was taking metformin. I was taking blood pressure medicines in the form of lisinopril and also metoprolol at one point. I was taking proton pump inhibitors, all of those things. Oh, and I was taking a statin. Since I started watching what I eat and trying to eat more healthy and low carb, I've lost almost 55 pounds. I'm not taking any prescription medications anymore. My blood pressure this morning was 110 over 68, with no blood pressure medicine. I'm not taking proton pump inhibitors anymore. I'm not taking metformin anymore. My glucose is perfect. My blood ketones are perfect. I'm sleeping better. I feel better. I could be a poster child for what you're talking about, because it's really been remarkable, the change in my physical, not only the appearance, but my physical, my well-being.
Yeah, I mean, and that's what I consistently see in my, metabolic health practice. And so, again, we have to start to question why did you need to discover that yourself? Why didn't a physician, guide you down that pathway? And, again, we see it time and time again. But if I go to go to the American Heart Association conference and present, that information, I would be, run out of the room and labeled a heretic. And, fortunately there is a community of physicians that are, now focused on this and are, trying to promote this information and make it, more acceptable and more mainstream, but it's very much an uphill battle for us to do that. And the other thing I just want to point out, based on what you said, is that, it is important for people to understand that you don't have to be obese to be metabolically unhealthy. You can exercise and be very active and still be metabolically unhealthy. And, so again, when people will say, when I'll sort of talk about what I talk about and people will say, oh, but I know this guy who was, a marathon runner and he still had a heart attack. And, that's what I point out to them. I say, being a marathon runner, being very active doesn't guarantee that you are metabolically healthy. So the proper way to go about this is figure out if you're metabolically healthy, get those five parameters that I just talked about, and find a physician who knows what they're looking at, and knows, understands what metabolic health is. When you focus on being metabolically healthy, you will prevent, you give yourself the best chance of preventing heart disease and a lot of other chronic diseases. When you look at the top 10 causes of death in this country every year, 7 out of 10 of them are clearly relatable to poor metabolic health. So just think about the impact we could have if we, were more focused on metabolic health. And, in the short term, when you look at, one of the things that has been very consistent about COVID, I think one of the things that is not controversial is we see that these same risk factors, being metabolically unhealthy, puts you at much greater risk of getting COVID and getting sick and having complications with COVID. So again, we should be looking at the basics here.
Yeah, that's huge. I mean, you posted an article, and this is a question for both of you guys. Dr. Avedia, you posted an article last week about COVID, and it looks like a CDC, on the CDC website, research done with a ton of authors. Seems like a very, very well-researched study, but it's looking statistically at the comorbidities with COVID, and it's all hypertension, lipid metabolism, obesity, diabetes, heart disease. I mean, that's basically all of them. One of the questions I have for you guys, and this is tied to that, but Dad, you retired last year, and Dr. Avedia, you left kind of standard practice and became an independent physician, operating your own business and doing locum tenens. How much, if you don't mind me asking, how much of that played a role in your willingness to think outside the box, to challenge the mainstream? I mean, how do you feel like that's played any part in your ability to sort of see some of these realities that you weren't seeing before?
Oh, certainly. I think, I think having your eyes opened to, quite honestly, how devastatingly, the healthcare system has failed around the issue of metabolic health and nutrition, you know, just opened my eyes to a lot of other things that were going on, you know, in medicine specifically and in society, you know, on larger scale. And then to have something like COVID come along. And again, you know, it's been obvious to anyone who wants to look, you know, all the statistics are out there that being metabolically unhealthy puts you at higher risk for COVID. So why have we not heard one public health official come out and talk about getting metabolically healthy? You know, and that's not to say that all the other things don't play a role, you know, vaccines and the therapeutics and, you know, everything else, you know, nothing that doesn't exclude any of that. But why has not one public health official, you know, why hasn't Dr. Fauci or anyone else come out and say, let's get metabolically healthy and we can do all the other stuff that we, you know, think might, you know, help minimize the impact of COVID. And you just got to start to question again, you know, you don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but you know, sometimes it becomes hard to comprehend of another reason why, you know, that isn't being said.
Well, the food industry isn't interested in people stopping eating carbs, and the industry that, you know, big pharma is not interested in people stopping taking statins. So that's that could be a big part of it. And that does sound conspiracy theorist, but, you know, I think from my perspective as a malpractice defense lawyer, in this day of subspecialization, medicine has become reactive and not proactive. You know, the fact that you're a cardiothoracic surgeon and that you're giving these messages that you are is highly unusual for a cardiothoracic surgeon. I've represented lots of cardiothoracic surgeons in my career, and most of them are so busy doing CABG surgeries that they don't have time to do what you're doing. And I feel the same way about my field of endeavor. When you're so stressed in your job that you don't have time to sit and listen to a podcast or read articles, then you're ignorant to these things that are going on, and you have to trust whoever is telling you what you should do. And that's what we all do.
To me, you don't have to be a conspiracy theorist, and that's the important thing. It's all very, very rational to me that if you're the inventor and hold the patent on statins, that you're going to do your darndest to produce evidence that they work, right? And you're going to do your darndest to put that evidence in front of the people that prescribe it. So that's just self-interest. That makes sense. They're a business. They need to run a business. They need to do what they can. Right. And then, like you said, Dad, that physicians are very busy, and everyone's guilty of confirmation bias, and we and guilty of, you know, being too busy to really do all the research and homework, and the way that practices are set up these days, you know, and the main prescribers obviously of statins, and the people that could catch this are your primary care doctors. They've got to have, you know, 2,000-3,000 patients per doctor just to break even with the current state of medicine. They've got to have a whole army of administrators to fight with insurance companies to get paid, and the reimbursements are garbage. I mean, they're sort of in a spot where they have to work crazy hours and then go home and work even more hours, you know, charting, just to stay afloat, right, as a business. And so there's no blaming them for going, I need the easy button, and I've got it right here. Here's peer reviewed research. It's considered standard of care. Boom, boom, boom. Let's, you know, next person on the, you know, on the schedule. Let's keep the patients flowing.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly it. And this is another large part of my messaging, you know, to the individuals out there, to the patients, that you need to be in control of your health. You know, the food industry is not there to keep you healthy. And I don't blame them for that. You know, the food industry is there to increase the profits of the food industry. And the way to do that is to, you know, produce more food that keeps you hungry all the time. And you know, the pharmaceutical industry is there to sell pharmaceuticals. They're not interested in keeping you healthy. The only people who are, you know, have interest in keeping you healthy are you and then hopefully your physician. But realize that the physician oftentimes, for all those reasons you outlined, is, you know, prevented from doing so, you know, preventing from having your best interests in mind, or just doesn't have the time, you know. As you said, we've gotten to a point where the primary care physicians are so overworked, you know, have to be managing, you know, too many patients, and the appointment times are too short, and it's much quicker just to check the box and hand the script than to have, you know, the extended discussions around, you know, metabolic health and diet and lifestyle. And, you know, that's why, you know, oftentimes patients need to either do this on their own or, you know, basically go outside the system and find physicians. A lot of the physicians I interact with in the metabolic health space are leaving, you know, their traditional primary care practices. They're going into direct primary care, concierge type setups where they can get out from under the influence of the insurance companies and, you know, get back to truly taking care of patients. And it's better for the patients. It's better for the physician. You know, there are so many physicians that I talk to in that, you know, who have made that transformation. And, you know, it's just amazing that they are once again enjoying being physicians, which unfortunately, you know, many physicians don't enjoy it anymore.
Well, this is who we talk to day in and day out every day, are physicians who are unfortunately at, you know, 45 years old, 50 years old, are already talking about, like, I got to retire. I'm all I can think about is early retirement because I got to get out. And it's really a crisis, you know, that's unfolding in front of our eyes as we're having this whole system, this healthcare system, has set itself up to, you know, again, you have to hear that I'm not saying this, like, I think there's some, you know, man, behind the curtain who's pulling all the strings, some evil guy that's twisting his mustache. But unfortunately, it seems that the healthcare system that we have today keeps doctors overworked, keeps patients, coming in for procedures and prescriptions. And it's not helping, you know, it doesn't seem to be helping anybody but the big companies who are making a ton of money. Putting someone on a diet, who benefits when you put someone on a diet?
Yeah, only the patient, you know, and again, if it's the proper diet, because even, you know, that term has become corrupted, you know, a diet has become, you know, some Weight Watchers or NutriFast or whatever it is that, you know, ultimately doesn't work as well. And, you know, getting back to the physicians, you know, part of the reason that I think physicians are becoming so burnt out is we are not seeing, you know, ultimately, you know, physicians want to see their patients get better. And we just don't see that. You know, when you look at the management of type 2 diabetes, you know, it's, you know, put the patient on metformin or some other medication. But the physician in the back of their mind knows that, you know, you're going to keep going up on the medications, and then you're going to go on insulin, and then you're going to start, you know, seeing the complications such as, you know, needing amputations or kidney failure, ending up on dialysis. And you know, there's just no hope there. Whereas when you look at the work that, for instance, Virta Health is doing, and Virta Health has now published their data showing that over 60% of the patients that came to them with type 2 diabetes have had their type 2 diabetes reversed with dietary and lifestyle interventions. And so you look at that data that is much better than anything else that we're accomplishing in the healthcare system around type 2 diabetes, and it's more cost effective. And you say, why isn't this everywhere? You know, when Virta published that data now, I think it's almost a year ago, it's at least 6 months ago that data was published, and you did not see it on the front of any mainstream newspaper. You know, that should have been headline on the front of New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and every other, you know, newspaper in this country, that 60% of people reverse their type 2 diabetes. And it wasn't, and it's not talked about in the medical community, and it was just roundly ignored.
Well, again, you know, we keep talking about conspiracy theory, but it shouldn't surprise us that the people who stand to make money off of the status quo are going to do their best to kind of control as much of the narrative as they can, get as much influence over what's published and what gets attention. So it's in their best interest, and so and a treatment like this doesn't seem to benefit things that they, you know, drugs that they've invested billions and billions of dollars to get to market. So they really are not all that interested, obviously, in seeing a new, better, more effective treatment come and render theirs, irrelevant. So again, I don't think it's some big dark conspiracy. It's just natural self-interest of these companies and these in the industry. What do you guys think about this is related to everything we've been talking about, but it's maybe a bigger picture question. When you have a hammer, everything seems to, you know, everything suddenly looks like a nail, right? And it seems to me that we sort of take our current set of tools, diagnostic tools and therapeutic tools, and start looking for nails. You know, we've got these hammers, let's go look for nails. And I've become really skeptical about the benefit even to, you know, it's become doctrine in our current system that you need to get your PSA levels checked all the time, and you need to get your, you know, women need to get their breasts, you know, examined on a, you know, on a regular basis. And we need to check our cholesterol levels, and we need to, there's all these metrics, these risk factors that we're supposed to be keeping an eye on. It seems to me again that we start down this path of treating for risk factors rather than treating disease. And again, my cynical nature is, you know, if you gave me as a businessman the opportunity to sell, solutions to disease or to risk factors, I'm going to pick risk factors every day because it's a much, much bigger pool. There's data, you know, I shared with you the book Risky Medicine. I feel like he talks about this. There's a lot of data to show that there have been times where testing for different cancers has actually led to more deaths, because of false positives and treatments for things that weren't there. I'll lob that one back to you guys. This skepticism that I have, and I wish I had a, like you said, I wish that, like, I certainly need to take responsibility for my own health, but I also wish I had a doctor who I felt like was being skeptical on my behalf, right? Cause then I wouldn't feel like I've got to go out there as an uneducated schmuck trying to make sense of all this. I wish that I had a physician who I knew was skeptical, but I don't. And so I'm probably in a precarious position where I'm dubious of all the things I'm being told I'm supposed to do.
Larson, let me respond to that before Dr. Ovadia, because I know he's got a much more educated response than I'll have. But as a person who has been the beneficiary of knowing health data, Dr. Ovadia, my dad died of prostate cancer. So I was always having my PSA checked, and I checked my PSA twice a year. And when I was 62, my PSA was going up, levels were going up. I had a biopsy and they found cancer. I had surgery. The surgery showed that all of the cancer was contained within the capsule of the prostate. And my surgeon told me, well, the good news is, or the bad news is, you're still going to die. The good news is you're not going to die of prostate cancer. So so to me, knowing the data of your health data is a good thing, not a bad thing. How you respond to it and how the doctor reacts to it is a different story, of course. But I don't see any problem with knowing your healthcare data. That's why I check all kinds of different levels all the time for myself. It seems to me that saying, "Gee, I don't want to overwhelm myself with this data, therefore I'm just going to stick my head in the sand," I don't think that's probably the right answer from my perspective. What do you think, Dr. Vadia?
Yeah. And again, I think it's a matter of, you know, you gotta get the right data, and you gotta, you know, do the right things with those data. If the data that we're gathering is to support sort of preconceived, you know, notion. So, you know, again, I'll just go back to cholesterol. You know, why do we check LDL cholesterol so frequently? It's so that we can, you know, basically just find more people who have an elevated LDL cholesterol and therefore, you know, according to the guidelines need to be, treated. We have a test. And again, you're talking about, you know, markers of risk versus actual disease. So again, around heart disease, there is a test that's available. It's called a coronary artery calcium score. It's a non-invasive CAT scan. It is inexpensive to do. It is low dose radiation, and it will show you whether or not you have buildup of calcified plaque in the arteries of your heart. And that test has been shown to be incredibly well predictive of heart disease. Again, much more predictive than an LDL cholesterol level will be. The statistics show that if you have a CAC score of zero, meaning you have no, you know, calcification in the arteries of your heart, if you get this scan done, you know, sometime between your 50 and 60 years old, and you have a CAC score of zero, your 10-year risk of subsequently developing atherosclerotic heart disease is 1%, or maybe even a little less. So again, much better predictor of heart disease than your LDL cholesterol number. Yet it is very rare that that test gets utilized. And the ironic thing is that test is actually in the guidelines. If you look at the latest, you know, revision of the guidelines around the management of high cholesterol, it says that a patient who is at low risk for heart disease from other reasons, who only has an elevated LDL cholesterol as their only risk factor, a CAC scan should be considered, it says. And the data, again, that has come out, you know, shows that if a patient with a high LDL cholesterol, no other risk factors for heart disease, has a CAC score of zero, there is no benefit to prescribing statins. And yet, you know, most physicians don't know that detail of the guidelines. And, you know, it is exceedingly rare that, you know, patients come to me having had a CAC scan done. It's something I order very often, but it's rare that patients come to me having had a CAC score done.
My perspective on this, just to kind of, and again, I think both my dad and I are really interested in hearing your thoughts on this, Dr. Avedia, but it seems to me that, like you said, LDL is a factor in heart disease, and it shouldn't be ignored when you're trying to get a full picture and understanding of it. The question is, why are you checking it? When do you check it? And to me, you check it when you've got reason to believe there's heart disease, and that reason is presenting itself in other ways, right?
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, I do think it should, you know, I do think we should be trying to identify these, you know, risk factors early, because you can intervene early. So again, when you look at metabolic health, you know, we know that 10 years prior to the development of, you know, overt metabolic syndrome, patients' fasting insulin levels will be elevated. So if we were to check that fasting insulin level, you know, 10 years prior, we could intervene and we could stop that process. But we never check fasting insulin levels, and we only get alerted to the problem, you know, either when the patient is overtly diabetic and showing symptoms of it, or, you know, we get a hemoglobin A1C now is, or fasting glucose is, you know, a fairly routine part of our blood work. By then, you know, again, the damage has been being done for, you know, 10 years. So I am a big fan of checking, you know, these markers early and then being able to intervene early. It's just a matter of checking the proper markers. So I go back to those basics, you know, the five measures of metabolic health. If anyone wants to start, you know, simply start with those five measures. Know what your blood pressure is. You know, if it's over 130 over 85, or if you're taking blood pressure medication, you know, that is a marker of poor metabolic health. Measure your waist circumference. If you're a man and it's over 40 inches, or you're a woman and it's over 35 inches, that is an indicator of poor metabolic health. measure your fasting glucose level. If it's over 100, or if you're on medication to lower your glucose, that is a marker of poor metabolic health. And then measure your triglyceride level. If it's more than 150, poor metabolic health. And the final thing is you measure your HDL cholesterol level. And if you're a woman and it's under 50, or you're a man and it's under 30, those are markers of poor metabolic health. And when you look at it, 88% of the adults in the United States, based on the most recent data available to us, that's the 2016 NHANES data, 88% do not meet all five measures of metabolic health. And having only one of those is a warning sign that you're headed down a bad pathway. And if you don't do something to reverse it, you know, you're going to end up 10 years down the line being overtly diabetic, having high blood pressure, having heart disease, and all the other consequences that come of it.
Well, I really want to keep fighting about PSA, but I probably shouldn't, because it's outside of the scope of the conversation. But I think it dovetails, and so the only comment I want to make there, and we can move on, because I also know that we've run out of time. Dr. Avedi, I know you have another meeting, but I think it's the general. It's coming back to the skepticism issue and the question of why are you measuring it, and is there a solution? With prostate cancer, we know that something like 75% of men will get it, and most won't die of it. It'll be present when they die, but it's not the cause, the primary cause or underlying cause. And so it comes back to, what solutions do you have? I think at the end of the day, if I felt like, and this is a call, this is a podcast that's listened to primarily by physicians. The call is, I think there's been a lot, especially this year, to undermine the credibility of to a lot of Americans, of the healthcare establishment. And I think there's more skepticism than there ever has been amongst patients. And I think it's a good thing. It's also a dangerous thing, because we're not educated. We're not trained. And so this is a call, for a plea really from me to physicians, please be skeptical on behalf of your patients. And I think you will find that to give you even greater credibility and greater compliance probably from your patients to follow your guidance. If they see that this is somebody who's really challenging the data, challenging the status quo, and cares about the N of one that's sitting in front of them, and not necessarily the population health sort of.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's well said. I think physicians need to start, demanding our autonomy back. We need to take back control of the healthcare system. And we need to do that, partnered with and for the benefit of our patients. And that needs to be the singular focus. And you really need to start, as a physician, you really need to start looking at those other influences that are getting in the way of that, and questioning, what you can do. And that might look different for everyone, for all the physicians out there. That might be different answers to that question. But like you said, we got to start questioning this.
Well, and I think one solution we've already alluded to, and self-interested plug at some level too, but changing up the question of how much face would you lose? How much of an impact would it make on your business and your standing within the medical community that you're in today? If you were to start challenging and pushing back, even if you were convinced by the data, convinced by the by even the anecdotal experience, if you're in a situation where challenging the status quo is just not an option professionally, then maybe consider doing what Dr. Avedi has done and try to restructure your professional situation so that you can be autonomous and independent. Could you tell us, Dr. Avedi, where, if people want to learn, I'm sure we've got a lot of folks who listen to this and want to find out more about what you're doing, how you've done it, how you've arrived there. I think both physicians and potential patients. Can you tell us how folks can find your information?
Sure. Social media, I'm most active on Twitter. I'm at iFixHearts on Twitter, and then OvadiaHeartHealth.com. So OVADIA HeartHealth.com is my practice website. And any patients that are interested in signing up for my newsletter, getting on my email list, or even potentially joining the practice, there's an avenue there to do sort of a discovery call with me around that. And my book is going to be published in November. It's called Stay Off My Operating Table. And I'm going to be having a podcast by the same name, Stay Off My Operating Table, launching pretty soon as well. Please be on the lookout for that.
That's awesome. Will you tell, final question, because I think... This kind of ties back to the overarching theme of this podcast, which is encouraging doctors to consider branching out in different ways. Can you give us, as our time expires here, could you give us a snapshot, of that experience for you, what you've learned? Are you happy about this change in practice? How's it going for you? Would you recommend other folks follow this journey?
Yeah, I think this has been incredibly rewarding. It has, kind of reignited my passion around medicine. And, I hear that from, the physicians that I interact with largely in the metabolic health space who have done the same. The satisfaction of, seeing patients actually improve on a daily basis is invaluable. So, it's not easy. It's a challenging path to go down. And quite frankly, there is some risk involved with it. But for me, the benefits have been, innumerable. So I'm willing to take that risk. And more and more so, I cannot stay silent anymore. It's one thing I could just have my practice and sort of be taking care of myself professionally and doing all these things. But I cannot just sit still and watch all the other physicians, be destroyed by the system. And so more and more I'm talking out about it. I'm becoming more vocal about it. And, ultimately that may put my, put me sort of in the crosshairs and put me in some danger. And maybe I'll be calling your dad for some advice on how to handle that. But, like I said, I just cannot live with myself. When you know about these things and you see how broken the system is and how it is failing the patients, ultimately, I could not live with myself as a physician if I wasn't, being vocal and speaking out about these things.
Well, good for you, Dr. Ovadia, and we really do wish you all the best, and thank you, honestly, thank you for speaking up. I think you're doing a great service to obviously your patients, but I think to everybody. We're all part of this healthcare system, and sometimes it's it takes just a little bit of pushback, by a few brave people to create this cascade that turn into these major turning points and breakthroughs. So I believe that you're part of that, and I think you're going to be part of that. And I think that if we keep both of us and my dad included and folks who are listening to this, if we keep pushing for more physicians to kind of open their eyes to these realities, I think we're going to make a big impact. I think we stand to make a big impact on the healthcare system and on a lot of patients' lives.
Larson, can I make a couple of comments, closing remarks that you can edit out if you choose to, but I just want to say from the perspective of a malpractice defense lawyer, I can tell you that in my experience, and I've represented hundreds and hundreds of doctors over the years of all different specialties, and I can tell you that the vast majority of them care about their patients. I mean, even the most entrepreneurial doctors that I know still care about their patients and want what's best for their patients, and that's a good thing. Number two, doctors don't realize, and I get frustrated with them a lot. They don't realize that they are the key to the healthcare system. they're being manipulated by hospital corporations, by pharmaceutical corporations, by different, and they really do need to join together to make their practice better. And then number three, I can say my primary care physician is a physician who chose to go to the concierge type of system, and because she just couldn't treat the patients the way she wanted. She's very thorough, couldn't treat the patients the way she wanted to, and she moved to a concierge system, which she was sort of embarrassed by, but it really has helped her a lot to care more for her patients and to spend more time with her patients. And I think that's very fulfilling to her. So there are options out there. And Dr. Obeidia, I really do encourage you and hope for your success in what you're trying to do.
Well, thank you. And thank you guys for having me on. This has been great. And I look forward to following up with you more on all of this.
Yes. I hope this is the first of a lot of conversations. Thanks again for being on the show, both of you.
All right. We'll see ya.
Thanks for listening to Branch Out, a podcast by Sycamore. Be sure to visit sycamoredocs.com to connect with us, access the show notes, and sign up for our newsletter.